Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump on Wednesday announced he is replacing his re-election campaign manager, Brad Parscale, with longtime political aide Bill Stepien. The shakeup comes amid flagging poll numbers for Trump and an increase in coronavirus cases in key states. The president and his advisors have downplayed the danger and worked to discredit the public health experts advising the administration, particularly Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984. Presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden on Tuesday urged the president to stop playing politics with the pandemic.
Mr. President, please listen to your public health experts instead of denigrating them. Do your job, Mr. President, because if we can't deal with the public health crisis, we can't deal with the economic crisis.
Ken Rudin is host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll post a link to the podcast at WOSU.org/allsides. Meanwhile, welcome back, Ken Rudin.
Thank you so much for laughing at the thought of my name. That was very nice, Ann. Thank you.
I guess it's just, you know, that time of the week, but wow. What do you make of the timing of the campaign shakeup in the Trump campaign?
Well, two things. First of all, the thought of anybody else being a campaign manager other than Donald Trump is kind of silly, because just like when you pick a new chief of staff or a new secretary of state, you know that Donald Trump is his own secretary of state, his own chief of staff. So ultimately, it's Jared Kushner and Donald Trump who are running things. But having said that, there seems to be an effort by the president, not even seems, to scapegoat others. Obviously, when you have 138,000 Americans dying of the COVID-19 virus, you need somebody to point to and blame, and that is Anthony Fauci. And so with a campaign that seems to be in disarray, at least with current poll numbers, and remember, we still have 109 days to go,
right,
and that's a long time to go, but with the poll numbers showing the president trailing Vice President, former Vice President Joe Biden, Trump needs to blame somebody. So he blames Brad Parscale, who, you know, I mean, it's not that he's done anything wrong, but he's not done anything right. And of course, he did take a big hit for that, for touting what was going to happen, that big rally in Tulsa.
Right.
Last month, that turned into a complete flop.
The White House, though, did rebuke the anti-Fauci op-ed piece in the USA Today. It was written by Trump's trade advisor, Peter Navarro. Was it a bridge too far? I mean, what do you think the calculus was there?
Well, you know, something I can't imagine anybody, Peter Navarro or anybody, doing anything like that without tacit acknowledgement, if not approval, mm-hmm. from the administration. So given the fact that the Republicans have been passing out talking points, dismissing and denigrating everything that Anthony Fauci has been saying back in February, I mean, it's remarkable that a president who, including this month, would rather retweet Chuck Woolery, the former game show host, then Anthony Fauci on the severity of the virus, will still blame Fauci. So you know, the fact that Peter Navarro and others have been sending out these talking points saying how wrong Fauci has been, that's part of the administration's playbook, which is to, again, blame somebody else, blame China, you know, the Kung Flu. Let's blame China. Let's blame Fauci. Let's blame everybody else except my own handling of this this pandemic.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Don.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if Ken Rudin could comment on the fact that apparently today the White House and Trump has decided to have all the hospitals not report their findings to the Center for Disease Control, but instead to a central database somewhere in the White House and keep the CDC out of the picture.
Yeah, Ken.
You know something? I mean, Don, this is exactly what they're doing. First of all, has the CDC been on top of everything from the beginning? Have they been right from the beginning? Of course not. Anthony Fauci will be the first one to tell you that they've made mistakes because they don't really understand, or they didn't understand, or couldn't understand the severity and how fast the virus was spreading. But the fact that they won it under a White House control, the information out of White House control and away from the CDC, basically tells you all you want to know. I mean, the fact that you discount Fauci in the middle of a pandemic, you pull back U.S. funding for the World Health Organization in the middle of a worldwide pandemic. I can't begin to tell you how many times I've been on Ann's show to say that this is unbelievable or this is surreal. Well, nothing is unbelievable or surreal anymore if it keeps happening. And this is just one more indication of something that just makes absolutely no sense when you look at it logically.
Right. And I know you're not an expert on this particular issue, but
yes,
I'm kind of wondering is, do hospitals have to obey that, or can't hospitals send data wherever they want?
Well, that's a good question, and that's a very good question. I don't know the answer to. You know, when the president said not too long ago, the only reason we have more cases, and Sarah Cooper mocked this beautifully, but the only reason we have more cases is because we're doing more testing. And that sounds like a defense. That sounds like it's not so bad because we're doing more testing. Well, first of all, the number of tests that are being available are still woefully inadequate, and governors will tell you that. But it's almost like these numbers are not real, and the only reason they're so high, higher than any other country in the world, is because we're doing such a great job testing. The fact is, as recently as this month, he's still diminishing the severity of it. He's still saying that he and Betsy DeVos, his education secretary, say that that schools need to open in the fall. I mean, it's remarkable. Roger Stone can't go to prison because we're so afraid of the spread of the virus. But kids, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, can go to school because that's okay. It's the expression, I can't even. And I can't even.
Let's see. Charles from London Correctional. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning. It's no surprise to me that Ken Rudin's name brings joy, or yours for that matter. But I wanted to talk about the difference between Trump tactics and Republican policy. And speaking of scapegoating, the Republican Party is going to try and scapegoat Trump like they did Bush, and claim that all the bad things that happened during their administration, oh, that was them and not their policy. And it's surprising to me that people are taken aback at their supporters not accepting expertise. They've engendered this, denying of climate change, lying about cutting taxes, increasing revenues, lying about increasing minimum wage being a benefit to the economies where it happens, all these things they've been doing, lying about pollution. So to me, it's not a surprise. But like I say again, these are Trump's tactics, and that's different than Republican policy. So all these people who are coming out and saying, well, I'm going to vote for Biden because I want to vote against Trump, need to be aware of the fact that it's just Trump's onerousness that you're against. But the truth is the policies are also what you're against, immigration. These are Republican policies.
Wait, Charles, hang on. I want to get Ken's feedback on your idea that they'll do to Trump what they did to W.
Well, Charles has a lot of things to say there, and a lot of them are worth it. We are, talking about. First, let me say I agree completely that the president's refusal to believe in science and experts. I mean, remember, he knows more than the generals. He said that from the beginning as well. So that's part of the pattern. But in following up on what Ann just said, and I don't know, Charles, if I agree with you. I know the Republicans did break from Bush. George W. Bush, and that's kind of what led to the Tea Party and things like that, and the fact that Bush had these tremendous deficits and all these things that went wrong, and conservatives said he wasn't the true conservative. And so you saw many members of Congress form the Freedom Caucus because they didn't like the way the establishment led by President Bush would do the policies. Republicans are not breaking away from Donald Trump. They're just not doing it. The few that have done it have paid the price. Look at Jeff Sessions.
But even Jeff Sessions, in losing that primary, still supports the president.
Right. Nobody break. The few who have broken are people like Mark Sanford and Jeff Flake and Bob Corker. And where are they now? Nowhere. So, I mean, there is, you know, the Lincoln Project, where you're seeing these devastating commercials by Republicans about President Trump. But the fact is, if you look at the members of Congress, you look at people running for office, they cannot get close enough to President Trump. I see no sign at all from the Republican Party breaking away from the president.
I started to see signs pop up about sending the kids back to school, you know, in referencing the president, that he's willing to sacrifice our kids by sending them back to school. Just handmade signs going up. What do you think they're thinking is when it, you know, Betsy DeVos and others, when it comes to this?
The president is desperate to get things back to normal. Remember the last time he turned around, not too long ago, should I say, the economy was humming along fine. Unemployment was at record lows. Things were going relatively well. I mean, you could argue about policies all you want, but the economy seemed to be humming. And as James Carville said, you know, the economy is often what decides whether a president is reelected or not. Mm-hmm. When that fell apart in the beginning of late February, beginning of March, to dramatic points where tens of millions of people were filing for unemployment, businesses were shuttered, the stock market was tumbling, the president just was just freaking out on that. So that really affected his mindset about the way things are. So, and that's why that's part of the blaming of others, the shock about a re-election that seemed to be in the bag for him, that is no longer the case.
What did you make of his Rose Garden address, I guess it was a presser on Tuesday after Joe Biden's remarks on energy and renewable energy and the economy?
It was unhinged. The fact that stations will cover it. I mean, he is the president of the United States and he should be covered. But this was just basically an all out a stream of conscious attack on everybody who's just done him wrong. And then, of course, is Joe Biden. I mean, one of the things that startles me, forget about all the attacks on Biden, because he's been doing that since the Ukraine telephone call, because he always saw that Biden would be his toughest opponent. But the fact that he says to the media that one reason you're not going to want Biden as president is because you're going to get low ratings. That is such a Trump mindset. But the thought of saying that, not that he'll endanger the security of America or he'll open up the borders, but the ratings will be poor. That's just wild stuff. One of the reasons, of course, there are repeats and everything, but one of the reasons I stopped watching Stephen Colbert and Saturday Night Live is because what is crazier and more insane than the reality? And so I stick to the White House for my insane reality.
We are talking politics today with Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We're going to talk about those Senate races in play and much more. If you have a question or comment for Ken, we welcome your participation. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Renewed calls for racial justice continue to reverberate across the country nearly 2 months after the Minneapolis police killing of George Floyd. In an interview with CBS News on Tuesday, President Trump said Floyd's death was terrible. But the president appeared defensive when asked why black Americans are, quote, still dying at the hands of law enforcement in this country.
And so are white people. So are white people. What a terrible question to ask. So are white people. More white people, by the way. More white people.
We're talking about that and more politics today with Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Check out the link to that podcast on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. So, again, another calculus question. What is that? What's going on? Is that just the proverbial dog whistle or what, Ken?
Well, it is a dog whistle. It's not even a dog whistle. It's their policy. It's the administration's policy. I mean, I understand you're supposed to appeal to your base. I understand that. Let's not even say racist. Let's just say a racial appeal to voters is just unconscionable. And the fact is that the constant talking about Confederate monuments and culture and heritage and history and white people, if George Wallace said it, and maybe George Wallace, I don't remember George Wallace's campaign for the presidency in 68, especially in 72, was far less overt than what we're hearing now. I mean, Wallace did have code words about talking about block voters and silent Americans and things like that, but open appeals to Confederate traditions and white people is just, you know, we might as well have George Lincoln Rockwell come back and campaign for this. This is just really, you know, there are a lot of, I have a lot of friends, I still have a lot of friends who believe in Trump because they like the policies. They believe in the conservative foreign policy. They believe in the judges and things like that. Mm-hmm. But to have open appeals, especially in a time when the country is wrestling with its racial and racist past, and the systemic racism in the country, and when people are just finally trying to come to terms with it, especially white people who have denied inherent racism for the longest time, and to have a president not soothing the American nation, not being the consoler in chief, but instead going out and saying things like, you know, obvious appeals to race, first of all, it's dangerous and it's unproductive. You know, when Mitt Romney lost in 2012, the Republican Party said, we need to realize that demographics in this country are changing. We need to, mm-hmm. if we can ever win again, we need to just reassess the way we approach politics. But Trump says, no, I think, you know, this is definitely working. Let's win at all costs before these demographics do change. And it's just it's reprehensible is what it is, because it splits the country even more at a time when the country cannot afford to be divided any further.
The biggest primary race this week had former Attorney General Jeff Sessions losing to Trump-backed Tommy Tuberville, former Auburn coach. What stood out to you about the results? I've already mentioned that even in his concession speech, Jeff Sessions was still saying he supports the president.
Well, you know, it was always sad to watch Jeff Sessions throughout this whole thing, because even when he was still attorney general and basically the Trump was just using him as a whipping boy and embarrassing him and denigrating him and making fun of him, Sessions never backed down, never said, I never wavered in his support of the president. Mm-hmm. After he was fired as attorney general and he got back into the Senate race in Alabama, hoping to win back the seat that he had given up to become attorney general, he said, I'm going to fight for the Trump agenda. Nobody's going to do it more so than I will, you know, more than I. So it was sad to watch it. Not that I feel great sympathy for Jeff Sessions. But look, let's face it, if it weren't for Jeff Sessions, we would never have Robert Mueller, although not that Robert Mueller made a big deal anyway, but all these investigations probably wouldn't have happened had the attorney general not pulled himself out of the investigation, so recused himself. So I felt it's sad, but the real story about this is that this is a seat that the Democrats are almost assured to lose. This is for the Democrats to keep talking about hoping of winning back the Senate. You know, they need a net gain of 3 if Joe Biden wins, 4 if they don't, because then they would, you know, if 3, then they have the vice president to break the tie. If they don't have the vice president, they need a net gain of 4. But it becomes an extra number because of Alabama, because Doug Jones is probably not going to win in a state that is one of Trump's best states. Mm-hmm. And so Tuberville is going to probably be the next senator, even though he has not had a press conference, not spoken to the media. I don't think he's even campaigned in the runoff. He's not told anybody where he stands on things, except the fact that he has the president's endorsement. So right. The real story is not so much the sadness, the almost the pathos of Jeff Sessions, but the fact is this is the seat that Democrats are most likely going to lose, and therefore they have to add at least another state that they're going to pick up if they are going to make Chuck Schumer the majority leader.
And as an aside, Tuberville needs to switch how he spells his name, because I was just corrected by my board operator on my pronunciation. It's Tuberville.
Well, that's okay. But the thing is, if you were a football fan in Alabama, exactly. Believe me, you would know how to pronounce
exactly.
His name.
And he's nodding at me right now. Yeah,
right. He's not. You wouldn't say Woody Hayes. You know what I mean?
Let's see. Let's get some.
I think
calls
Ohio knows that it's Woody Hayes, right?
Let's see. We have everybody knows Woody Hayes. John in Worthington, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, John.
Hi, Ann. I wanted to get Ken's opinion on a recent article I read online from NBC News, postulating that Trump is presently attempting to establish Biden as China's candidate and potentially establishing a connection between China and election fraud with regard to mail-in voting. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, in the event of a loss, Trump will claim that China interfered with the election and cast doubt. And that was just my question.
This has been a strategy he's been working on for a while. Yeah.
This is not an uncommon question. This is not, and it's also not an unimportant question. This is significant because as bad as what Russia seemed to do in 2016 in trying to pull the election Trump's way, the fact that the president is already talking about how this election is fixed, that it's in the bag, that it's going to be corrupt, that China is printing fake mail-in ballots and they're going to flood the country with mail-in ballots. Once you put doubt into the American people's heads about the fairness of the system of government, then we've lost. We failed. And as you know, remember, people forget this, but I think during the debates with Hillary Clinton in 2016, Trump was asked whether he'll accept the results. And he said, well, if I win, I'll accept it. But I don't know if I'll accept it if I lose. There are a lot of people who fear that he'll just say this is, and who knows if he'll have a compliant attorney general backing him up. Yeah. And it just sounds like a weird, paranoid, fright fantasy, but who knows anymore? But the fact is that he is talking about that this is going to be a fixed election, that these mail-in ballots are going to be printed by China, and they're going to destroy this, you know, disturb, not Russia, of course, because Russia can't do anything wrong. You know, the fact that they have a bounty on American soldiers in Afghanistan, he doesn't know anything about that and won't comment about that. But China, that's what the president does. But putting doubt in people's minds about the fairness and the sanctity of this election, if it diminishes turnout, that is criminal. That is just, you know, the worst part of the worst of the worst. And so, you know, you read about the new things about the hacking of the Twitter accounts of Joe Biden and other people, you know, with this Bitcoin stuff. If they could hack Twitter accounts, maybe they could hack the vote. This is not a paranoid, exercise in paranoia. I think this is legitimate fears. And, something like, and I keep, I'm going back to the Ken Rudin saying, well, I believe in this. I've been doing politics for so long.
I miss our old conversations.
Love the way I love baseball is the way I love politics. Yeah. But these are frightening times.
Exactly. I mean, we used to talk about politics like we talk about sports. Not that I can really talk about sports, but
and Woody Hayes.
All right, John in Worthington, thanks for that call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking politics with Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, and we're taking your calls or emails. The number to call is 614-292-8513. The email address is allsides@wosu.org. And Robert in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Okay.
Good.
I'd just like to talk to Ken about the recklessness of the president to send kids back to school. There's a pandemic going on, so the president wants to kill our children also. And I'll turn it back over to you.
Yeah, back to that issue of schools and the pandemic.
Well, I will never say that the president wants to kill anybody or certainly our children, but this is, but basically it amounts to that. The fact is, and let me, before I get back to the schools and the children and Betsy DeVos for a second, we were told back in May and June that while things may be slowing down a little bit, it's going to get much worse. And he said, and the president would say, liberate Michigan and liberate Minnesota and open up the businesses. And so governors, the governor of Florida, the governor of Georgia, the governor of Texas, the governor of Alabama, Arizona, they would all take his cue and start to open up. You know, what's wrong with the beaches? You know, let's open up the restaurants. Let's open up the bars. Let's have a rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where nobody wears a mask. This is madness, and people are getting sick and they're dying, and for the president to blame China and Biden and others other than his own malfeasance is just upsetting. So you know, back to Robert's point about kids going to school, this is not about me, but would I let my kid go back to school at a time when the pandemic is increasing? I mean, I'm in Florida. I'm talking to you from Florida right now, where last Sunday there were 15,000 new cases. The beaches, I mean, people are still going to the beaches and nobody's wearing masks. Would I have my child going? Absolutely not. And the fact that people are just, there's no blowback from the Republicans in Congress at all. And the people you do are hearing back are from Matt Gaetz and Jim Jordan and others who are saying that, you know, these are the liberals who are fighting and the Republicans are standing by the president. Someday, someday there's going to be a rendering about this. And this, I don't know if it's going to be anytime soon.
You mean a reckoning.
Soon. A reckoning of this. And it's not going to be pretty, but I hate the thought of having it, for having it coming long time from now instead of right now in the next 109 days. Hmm.
Robert, thanks for that call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu. By the way, wosu.org. By the way, the Oklahoma governor has tested positive and is ill with the coronavirus.
Yes, and for example, Herman Cain was pictured in that rally without wearing a mask. Yeah. On Twitter, he said, you know, the big government, you know, Big Brother is making us wear masks. We're not wearing masks.
By the way, it's Dr. Herman Cain. I'm sorry. I'm confused. Yeah, go on.
Okay. No, Herman Cain, you know, he was the guy the 999 guy who ran for president in 2012.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I turn this argument upside down. It's 666. It sounds like it's the devil who's making these decisions here, because people are getting sick and people are dying. And instead of sympathy, we see finger pointing, blame Fauci, blame Biden, blame China, and not consoling the families of the 138,000 people and counting who have died and the millions who have contracted the disease.
I want to turn back to some of those Senate races. Senator Susan Collins of Maine will face Democratic Sarah Gideon in November. Obviously, this is a referendum on Collins. She has been a popular senator in Maine for a long time. What do you make about
Yeah, it's one thing to be, you know, a very strong conservative like Lindsey Graham or somebody who will do whatever Trump wants, like Mitch McConnell. But then you have Susan Collins, who for years has always been talking about, yes, she's a Republican and yes, she's a moderate Republican, but she always talks about her independence. Well, she argued in favor of Brett Kavanaugh during the confirmation hearings and argued in favor of her his confirmation. She argued against President Trump's conviction during the impeachment trial, saying he learned a lesson when he was impeached. He learned a lesson. So, and every time Trump does something that's distasteful, Susan Collins will say, I'm concerned. Well, you know, I mean, yes, I'm concerned, but show a backbone. Do show what John McCain did. I mean, John McCain stood up to the president. Mitt Romney is standing up to the president. And I'm not saying because Mitt Romney's right, but in these cases, he has a conscience. He sees what's happening, and he's risking his political standing, certainly in the Senate, certainly in Utah, although Utah's never been a really rabidly pro-Trump state. But Romney is standing up. Susan Collins won't do it. And so Sarah Gideon, who's the Speaker of the House of Representatives in Maine, who has raised far more money than Collins in the last quarter, she says, look, we've supported Collins in the past. She's been an independent. She's been a good voice. She's one of the reasons we have a two-party system. But she's no different than the Lindsey Grahams and the Mitch McConnells when it comes to judges and policies and things like that. I think she's going to lose. I think Susan Collins loses in November. Gideon is a good candidate. Maine is not as liberal as people think. They had a very, very conservative governor recently, Paul LePage, who was a Trump-like governor. They have a Democrat now, but they had a Trump-like governor for two terms.
But they're so independent. I mean, they're not liberal, but they're independent.
Well, yeah, exactly. They've elected, matter of fact, Angus King, the senator, is an independent. He was a former independent governor. They go their own way. Yeah. And I think that was said about Susan Collins and before that, Olympia Snow. But I kind of think that Sarah Gideon is making the case that that Susan Collins' time is up.
We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll get to more questions. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. He joins us every month. So stay with us. More talk. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking politics today with Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Link to the podcast is at WOSU.org/allsides. Ken, we have an email from Emily. She says, I'm thinking he didn't lose because I think she's referring to Jeff Sessions. That Jeff Sessions didn't lose because of lack of Trump support. I think he lost because people are tired of the same old, same old. Same potential for McConnell and Graham. Republicans had the open public, I guess, lifted the restrictions in public like they want, and we still have a poor economy. As history has presented, Democrats will get elected to fix it.
Well, that is the Democrats' hope, clearly. Do I think that Lindsey Graham in South Carolina and Mitch McConnell in Kentucky are going to lose? I don't. I think they have strong candidates. They have an African-American candidate in South Carolina in Jamie Harrison, who's running close to Lindsey Graham. They have a war veteran in Kentucky in Amy McGrath running against McConnell. But these are still rock-ribbed Republican states. Remember, Jeff Sessions didn't lose to a Democrat. He lose to an equally conservative Republican. So I don't think that there was the defeat of Jeff Sessions on Tuesday in Alabama was a repudiation of Republicans at all. It was just that Jeff Sessions had his time. Now, Jeff Sessions, I mean, was first elected to the Senate in 1996. Mitch McConnell was first elected in 1984.
You were barely born then.
He has 12 years on him. Yeah. But you know, my perfect example, last year in Kentucky, Matt Bevin was by far the most unpopular governor in the country. And he barely lost to Andy Beshear. It was very, very close. And he was vastly unpopular. So if somebody like that can just lose by the skin of his teeth, I don't, you know, unless it's a tremendous fall apart by Trump and the Republicans. Now, some people say there's been a fall apart for the last 4 years, but until something drastically happens, I'm not sure he brings down a lot of senators with him. Remember when George McGovern, I mean, not that we have to go back 100 million years, but when George McGovern got wiped out in 1972, and when Walter Mondale got wiped out in 1984, the Democrats didn't suffer. Matter of fact, in 1984, the Democrats picked up seats in the Senate, even though Mondale got clobbered. So I think voters are showing independence, and I'm not sure if Trump will bring anybody down. And for that reason, I think the old loyalties will exist in South Carolina and Kentucky. But having said that, there are states like, you know, like Arizona and Colorado and North Carolina and maybe even Iowa, where the Republican senators are in big trouble, and they could even perhaps even Montana. That would be a beaut. So I mean,
I think it's interesting, you know, and it's, I mean, it's all is just how I, you know, 10 years ago, if we would have been talking about those states, they are solidly rock ribbed Republican, and now they're shifting.
They are, but here's the thing. I mean, but here's the thing. Colorado is really, I mean, used to, it's been purple for a long time. Now it's really shifting to blue.
Right.
North Carolina, yes, Trump won it and Romney won it, but Obama won it in 2008. So these are vintage, historic swing, not historic, but clear swing states where either side can win it. And that's why you're going to see so much money pumped into the North Carolina, Colorado, Arizona, Maine states like that.
Al in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Al.
Hi, Ann. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Al.
So here's my question. So, Ken, why are the Democrats not making more noise about this Russian bounty hate situation? I mean, as the Republicans hammered the Benghazi to hurt Hillary, I think this Russian bounty gate should really be elevated to the forefront and consistently maintained. The American people really deserve an answer, and the president and the White House seem to be running away from this. And it just, like most news cycle, it seems like it's kind of fading away in the background. So what are your thoughts? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Al, I think the reason is I think Republicans are better at this than Democrats. They, you know, to say that they're more vicious, well, they may be. The fact is that, look, I mean, here's a perfect example. During the Access Hollywood tape, and when you hear the president on tape saying what he's done to women, and you think, my goodness, that would end anybody's candidacy. Mm-hmm. A few days later, the president shows up in a debate with all the women who have accused Bill Clinton of misconduct. I mean, there's no shame in the president, and they just could get very, very aggressive. So you're absolutely right. Benghazi, which to me is hardly, I mean, basically you have the president of the United States saying he never got notices about Russia putting these bounties with the Taliban on killing American soldiers. And the president saying, no, I never heard about it. And even if he did hear about it, he's not raising it with the Russians. He's not talking about it. And that's just remarkable. Why are the Democrats, I agree with you, why are the Democrats not saying this is, I don't know if it's treason, but it's something that's not right. You just don't do this. And the fact that the Republicans spent millions and millions of dollars on Benghazi and it was in the headlines all this time. All I can say is that the Republicans just do a far better job of this kind of politics than Democrats.
And I just wonder about that. Why? Why is that? Why don't Democrats take up the reins of these kinds of issues and just slam them?
Well, I don't know. Just the same reason why so many Democrats said, you know, Trump is, you know, really a monster. But you know, Hillary's emails. I don't know about Hillary's emails. They just seem to be so cautious. But I don't know. I mean, again, in the next 109 days, you know, we saw a lot of things that Hillary took a lot of things for granted in 2016. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of Democrats sat on their hands. When Democrats said, I'm going to vote for Jill Stein, they said, fine, do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's going to be more urgency. I think Obama may lead that urgency, saying, you know, get off your behind. And this is something that needs to be done because we can't have a repeat of 2016. If the Democrats are smart enough, I mean, they need to use their strength. And it just seems like they don't know how to do it.
Al, thanks for that call. We have a couple emails. This is from Jeffrey, who asks, what does Ken Rudin think of the president and his daughter posing with Goya products?
Oh, my. Oh.
Now, there's a question about ethics with
Ivanka.
Ivanka posing with it.
Yeah, she's basically saying, I mean, but look, a question of ethics. My goodness, there's been questions of Trump family ethics from January 20th, 2017, and nobody does anything about it. There's no ethics. There's no accounting for anything. But the fact is that the president, the head of Goya Foods, which is mostly, you know, historically been selling to Latino audiences, he said that President Trump is a great president, blah, blah, blah. So many in the Latino community said, I want to boycott Goya products.
Mm-hmm.
So then so in the middle of this pandemic, you see a smiling President Trump with about 8 different Goya products sitting on the desk in front of him with a big smile. You see Ivanka Trump holding up a Goya product with a big smile. This is part of, you know, I mean, the fact is we still don't know his financial statement. He's asked for another extension. We have no idea about the conflicts of interest, the financial conflicts of interest he may have, because he won't tell us. And so, you know, when I think of Rick Perry's presidential candidacy ending because he couldn't think of a third cabinet office that he would get rid of, and given what the president is doing, and his numbers haven't changed. They haven't gone up, but they haven't gone down. As a matter of fact, Biden's numbers have gone down lately, even though he still has a lead in the national.
But that's just going to happen as we...
But Trump's numbers are not going down.
Yeah.
They're not going down. He's still, I mean, a week ago or whatever it was, he was down 50 to 36 in one poll. Now it's 50 to 41 or 53 to 41. In other words, Trump's numbers are just not moving. And I think his calculation is maybe I'll never win over any additional voter, but I need to put doubt in people's minds about Joe Biden.
You know, remember Billy Beer?
Yeah, right. Billy Beer. Right. Right. That was a big deal at the time. Right?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it was, you know, the end of times. Let's see. Kenny in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kenny.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, okay.
2016, Donald Trump ran on anti-globalization. And I'm just wondering, with the Pacific Rim Act, which Hillary Clinton negotiated, a trade agreement with the other Asian countries, how do you think that's going to affect American foreign policy and affect our economic policy long term?
You know, Kenny, I don't know the answer to that, but just look at what the president has done and said regarding China. China is we have a great relationship with China. We're going to have a great trade deal, the greatest deal in history. President Xi and I he's a great person. We get along really well. And then, you know, maybe he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, and now China is the bearer of all ills. It's just, so I don't know if people vote on trade deals. I think, you know, the Democrats have been kind of tortured on trade deals, too. The more progressives like the Sherrod Browns of the world are not in favor of these, you know, these free trade agreements.
Mm-hmm.
But there are others who support them. I don't know if that's as big a deal as an issue in the election or not, but I just think that what Trump is doing is just so inconsistent. It depending on the time of day, whether he's for this, against it, for China, for Mexico, for Canada, or against it. It's just it's inconsistent at the minimum.
Kenny, thanks for that call. Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you both. I think Trump is toast. I hear the pundits say this race could still turn around. This is too big of a mess to clean up by Election Day. He's finished. I used to think he was Jimmy Carter. I'm thinking now he's Herbert Hoover.
Well, I don't share that. The fact is, I don't know. I mean, if the election were today, I would say Joe Biden does win. Do I think Joe Biden is going to win in November on November 3rd? I don't know. I don't know what the situation is to be with the virus. I don't know if people will be able to go to the polls. I don't know if Trump is going to discourage people from voting. I don't know if fake ballots. I don't know if what Russia is going to do. There are so many imponderables that are going to be net between now and the next 109 days. I don't know. But that just shows that every vote matters. You think of the 16,000 votes that Trump beat Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin, or was it Michigan? I think it was Wisconsin. I mean, it's just every vote matters. And you know, I mean, I live in Maryland, and of course, you know, I could be a Republican in Maryland, and my vote won't matter, but I could be a Democrat in Maryland, it won't matter either, because you know how Maryland is going to go. You know how California is going to go. You know how Texas is going to go. But there are states like Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Iowa and North Carolina and Florida that are so crucial to deciding the next president. And the question is, you just got to get out and vote. I'm not convinced. I don't look, the fact is, I don't know. There are October surprises. Trump is, I wouldn't put anything past Trump. And we could talk about who Biden picks as the vice president, whether that affects anything or not. But ultimately, I think this is going to go down to the wire, which is scary. I mean, the fact that it's now, you know, I mean, let me just say that the fact that we don't know who's going to win, or at least I don't know who's going to win, lets you know about the state of politics today.
Mark, thanks for that call. An email from Brad who says he says, what will it take for all the Republican enablers like our Senator Rob Portman and Representative Jim Jordan to stop putting Trump over country? It is clear that Jordan has found a shtick that works and hitched his wagon to Trump, while Portman seems content to explain away Trump's unconstitutional actions, too numerous to count. There has to be some consequence to buying into Trump's philosophy and the blatant corruption of the administration. Or am I just being naive?
Well, you're not being naive, but I think you did. There were two kinds of Republicans, and Brad makes a good point here, because picking out, singling out Portman and Jordan is a really good idea, because Jim Jordan is those will be Trump, you know, like those Republicans who stuck with Nixon, you know, even after the tapes came out showed that he was part of the cover up. I mean, they stuck with him to the very end. Rob Portman, and as far as Democrats are concerned, maybe there's no difference between Jordan and Portman, because they could say, well, look, if Portman is not going to stand up to the president and show any kind of backbone or spine, then who cares if he's wrestling with his problems, and who cares if he's decent guy? See, I happen to like Rob Portman. I think he's a decent guy. I think he's a good guy. And yet at the same time, does it matter if he votes to, you know, acquit the president, if he votes for all the judges? What's the difference between a Rob Portman and a Jim Jordan? The Republican Party has a lot of, you know, we always talk about reckoning after elections. Republicans had to do it after Goldwater in 64. They had to do it in 74 after Watergate. I don't feel that they feel an urgency right now to decide or break away from Trump now, which is I still think years away from coming. I mean, if Trump wins the second term, then maybe, and I don't know. I just don't know. But the Republicans are not standing up the way they did, like the Elliot Richardsons and the Barry Goldwaters and the John McCains that stood up to Republican presidents in the past. So in that sense, there really isn't much difference between Portman and Jordan.
Can Rudin talk next month?
We will. Hopefully we'll find things to talk about.
I know it's always so boring when you're on, but thanks for putting up with it. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Tommy Tubermill and I love this show.
Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for all the questions today. Have a good one. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.